This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we discuss the decision to drop the atomic bomb at the end of World War II. Was it necessary, as the official historical narrative suggests? Our guest today challenged that narrative and the untold history of Nagasaki. We're joined by Minister Nobu Hanaoka, Nagasaki bombing survivor. We're also joined by Professor Jacques Pauwels, author of The Myth of the Good War. Andrew Phillips also will speak with us later on in the hour about his 1984 interview with Wilfred Bercher, one of the first journalists on the ground at Hiroshima after the bomb dropped. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We're joined today by several guests that will shed some light on the Nagasaki bombing, on the use of weapons of mass destruction, and we'll also tie it to contemporary events. So we're certainly going to be looking at the untold histories here today. Our guests include Minister Nobu Hanaoka. We'll also be joined by Professor Jacques Pauwels, author of The Myth of the Good War. And later we'll hear from Andrew Phillips, who will be talking about some of his interviews with several people connected to the events of Nagasaki. Peter, please introduce our guest today.
Our first guest, Nobu Hanaoka, was living in Nagasaki, was 8 months old at the time when the bomb was dropped. His family was not close to the city center, so they were not affected by the blast and the fire, but they were seriously exposed to radiation. His father moved them out of the area after a couple of years to Nagasaki. They later lived in Tokyo and Osaka. Both Nobu's mother and his sister died of radiation poisoning when he was 6 years old. He went on to graduate from the School of Theology at Kanto Gakuin University in Okinawa in 1969. And then he traveled to the U.S., where he went to Colgate Rochester Divinity School in Rochester, New York, and was ordained a Methodist minister in 1972 and moved to Berkeley to study at the Graduate Theological Union. He's been an active minister up through 2008 and now lives in Daly City. Nobu, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We also have on the line Jacques Pauwels. He is a professor of history and political science at the University of York and the University of Waterloo. He's the author of the book The Myth of the Good War, America and the Second World War. Jacques, are you with us?
Yes, I am here. Good morning.
Good to have you on.
A pleasure.
We're going to start first with Nobu. Talk a little bit about what happened to your family that day and after, and the impacts on the city, and we want to get a little bit into the history, but tell us the personal story of your family.
As you said earlier, I was only 8 months old, and I have no personal recollection of the bombing itself. But I learned later we were not living close to the city center, but, you know, air we breathed, the water we drank, the food we ate were all contaminated with radioactive particles. And as far back as I can remember, both my mother and my sister looked very pale, and they were sick in bed. And when I was six, I think the first week of my elementary school, she died, and then my sister followed her soon afterwards. Because of the stigma attached to being Nagasaki survivors, the family didn't really talk about the radiation itself. And so I grew up not knowing exactly what happened. But when my sister died, I overheard my doctor talking to my father, saying that if we were all exposed to the same fallout, I would not live to see my 10th birthday. I was only 7 at the time, and so I always expected not to live beyond 10th or every year. You know, every time I caught a cold or something, I said to myself, this is it. This is the end of my rope.
You had a brother that passed away early on as well.
Right. Because doctor couldn't exactly say what caused his death. They performed autopsy, and when they opened him up, they realized that they noticed that his internal organs were all those of a 70-year-old man. He was only 40 at the time.
Wow. So you've had this sort of carried this your entire life.
Yes.
And now you're here in the U.S., a retired minister.
We're also joined on the phone by Professor Jacques Pauwels, who's author of The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War. Jacques, you're with us by phone.
Yes, I am. I'm here. Thank you.
Jacques, well, let's tie this in. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
We've had you on before with Peter Kuznick, author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. And in particular, there's a chapter four in their book, and also one of their shows on the Showtime series, literally focuses on the bomb and the dropping of the bomb and the decision to drop the bomb. Of course, the official narrative in the United States, and actually the Western narrative, has oft been one that embraced the bomb in Orwellian fashion as a means by which to save lives. And that narrative really lives through today in many cases, in the minds of many, propagandistically, we should add. But actually what it looks like upon further historiographic analysis is that these decisions weren't necessarily based on the idea of saving lives. They had other issues behind them. Could you talk to us historically about the decision to drop the bomb?
Yes, of course. I come from an opposite perspective compared to that of Nubu, who was there as a child. I wasn't around at all. In fact, I'm from Europe, and I decided I better be born after the war than during the war, which had certain advantages. But my focus, my background is in European history, and more specifically German history. And as such, of course, the Second World War was a big theme in my studies. And I came to study and to know more about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the context of the end of the Second World War in general. Actually, I might almost say first in the context of the end of the Second World War in Europe, the war against Germany, and secondarily the end of the Second World War in its entirety, also in the Pacific, which in Europe, of course, is not something that people think of much when they think of the Second World War. It's much more the case in the United States. Anyways, what I'm trying to say here is that I came to ask questions like the kind that you just suggested about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and try to find answers in light of the situation at the end of the war. And what we have here then is a double issue, really. One was to finish off the war in Japan and how best to do that. And the second issue was how to deal with the problems of the peace, because no sooner would the war end, everybody would knew that peace would break out and that would have complications and problems of its own, especially the relationship between the two emerging superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. I believe personally, and I'm not the only one, that the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki had in some ways very little to do with Japan, with the issue of finishing the war in Japan, but a lot more to do with dealing with the Soviets, so to speak, and thinking of the post-war situation. The idea of dropping the bomb, the idea that it was done to save boys, to finish off the war and so on, is still widespread in the United States, as I know, and also in the rest of the world, actually. And it started by, basically, because that was the official explanation given at the time by President Truman and by many of the other leaders that were, you know, basically involved in the decision-making processes at the end of the war. Because, of course, they could not reveal the true reasons for doing it, so to speak. So the official reasons were we had to finish the war because the Japanese otherwise wouldn't surrender, and we had to do it quickly. True, it's an awful thing, but the alternative would have been even worse. Well, that is simply not true at all. That's one thing we can say. And secondly, we can examine the real reasons. But let's start with the fake reasons, so to speak, with the rationale, as I would say. The rationale being then that we had to force the Japanese to capitulate one way or the other, and that way we save lives. Well, it's just simply not true, because to finish the war against Japan, there were a number of options that were very attractive and, looking back, actually very easy. And I'll quickly give them without going into much detail. But one of the ways in which the war could have been ended would have been to accept the Japanese offers to surrender on the basis of one small condition, and that was immunity for the emperor.
Jacques Pauwels, I just wanted to interject briefly, yes. And again, historiographically, again, as Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone wrote, there's a passage in their work that literally quotes Truman. President Harry Truman, it says, always claimed that he felt no remorse, even bragging that he, quote, never lost any sleep over that decision, end quote. And that decision meaning to incinerate over 100,000 lives of civilians.
Yeah.
And television interviewer Edward Murrow asked him, any regrets? And Truman responded, not the slightest, not the slightest in the world.
Well, I can believe that. Of course, people like Truman came up with rationales, but undoubtedly ended up believing in themselves. I don't believe in a way, I don't question in the sincerity, in quotation marks, of Truman when he said these things. He probably had persuaded himself that he had done something that was had made a good decision, that he had saved lives in some ways, and the lives he had saved were American and Allied lives, and the lives the people that he had condemned to death were enemy people. So I guess from seen in this light, I can understand that Truman, in a sense, congratulated himself and felt no remorse at all. But of course, that has nothing to do with the historical truth of the whole issue.
Jacques, we know that probably 50 cities in Japan had been already firebombed with massive casualties before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We dropped a bomb on Hiroshima on the 6th of August, killing close to 100,000 people. And then 3 days later on Nagasaki, that killed close to 75,000 people. And there was no time for the Japanese government in between the two bombings to have assessed what had really happened, because they couldn't understand if just one plane could have done the devastation that hundreds of aircraft were doing.
Yes.
So the decision to go ahead with Nagasaki and destroy that city was pretty quick.
Yes.
And done the same day that Russia, the Soviet Union, had declared war on Japan.
Yes, and that was the two are connected, of course, the two facts.
The two facts. And, of course, to speed up not only the end of the war, but to prevent the Russians from interceding in the East so that it could be an American peace and not really a Russian peace.
That is actually a very, very, very important consideration. The idea was that by dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, that the impact of that would be so tremendous that Tokyo would immediately, you know, surrender. And so let's look at the chronology here. If you drop the bomb on Hiroshima on the 6th of August, the expectation was that on the 7th or the 8th, the latest, Tokyo would wave the white flag. But somehow, as you mentioned, it didn't happen. And that must have been very, very frustrating for Washington. It didn't happen, and I think you're right, because Tokyo probably did not know exactly what happened in Hiroshima. And the destruction of the city was not unusual. In fact, Tokyo was probably had been flattened in a worse way before than Hiroshima. But of course, Hiroshima was flattened overnight by one plane using one bomb. And that is something that the government in Tokyo didn't know yet. So Tokyo did not respond immediately as expected. And the reason that was frustrating, disappointing to the people in Washington. But the second reason was disappointing was that they felt there was really, really time pressure, because the purpose of dropping the bomb, the real purpose now, not the one to save lives and to bring about the Japanese capitulation at all. No, the real purpose was actually to intimidate the Soviets. That's another thing actually we can talk about in a minute, but especially to prevent the Soviets from entering the war against Japan, which they were due to do at any time in the middle of August.
That's the voice of Professor Jacques Powell's author of The Myth of the Good War. We're also joined by Nobu Hanaoka, and you wanted to chime in here, Nobu.
Right, I agree completely with the professor. Before the Hiroshima bombing, actually, Japanese government had feelers out in terms of finding the acceptable terms of surrender. And when the U.S. government found out that Japanese were talking to the Soviet Union, asking to intervene between the U.S. and Japan, the U.S. had to drop the bomb to make sure not to give credit to the Soviet Union for ending the war, thus making sure the U.S. maintained its superpower status after the war. And the other thing is that the bomb dropped on Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb, and the Hiroshima bomb was an uranium bomb. And the U.S. Produced two types of bomb, and they wanted to experiment with two types of bomb, which would be more effective. And basically, Nagasaki, you know, of course, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, both people were used as guinea pigs. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, nuclear bomb is unethical because it's an indiscriminate, you know, mass killing. It's, you know, mass destruction, weapons of mass destruction is not a very good term. I think it's a mass murder machine. Mm-hmm. People who had nothing to do with the war effort were killed. In fact, in Nagasaki, there was the largest Christian church at the time in the whole of Asia, Urakami Catholic Church. They had 12,000 members. 8,500 of them were wiped out that day. There was no reason for that. They were conscious people. They were probably praying for the ending of the war.
And many prisoners of war were wiped out also.
Nobu Hanaoka, we live in an era now where we talk about terrorism and so-called wars on terrorism. And the late historian Howard Zinn always said that war is terrorism. And certainly looking at what happened to you and your family and so many others, that really is terrorism writ large.
Yes.
As you say, not just weapon of mass destruction, but literally mass murder of innocents, of many, many diverse people, as you described with the Christian church and so forth in Japan.
Yes, I agree.
Jacques Powell's, perhaps we can get you to comment on this issue. In terms of U.S. politics, some historians have argued the Secretary of State, James Burns, pushed Truman into dropping the bomb. Again, there's a lot behind that question or that comment. But what could you comment on that, if at all, on these decisions? And, for example, the technology was there. The U.S. doesn't drop the bomb in Europe. They drop it in Japan. Can you comment on that?
Well, like I was, as I was explaining earlier then, there was the official rationale for dropping the bomb, which didn't make sense, but which is still widely believed today and disseminated by our media, unfortunately. And then there's the real reasons, and the real reasons, as I mentioned, have to do with the Soviet Union. And it's not a surprise you mentioned Burns, because he, of course, is the gentleman who is very much concerned with international affairs of post-war America and the post-war problems of the world and relations with the Soviet Union in particular. Now, with respect to the Soviet Union, then there's really two issues, two ways in which this is relevant for the bombings of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. One was to prevent the Soviet Union, to prevent them from getting a chance to get involved in the war against Japan. And this is important because the United States had always pressured Stalin to declare war on Japan as soon as possible. Now, during the war, neither the Soviet Union nor Japan could afford to fight each other, as they were both fighting the mortal enemy. The Soviets were fighting the Germans on the Eastern Front, and the Japanese were fighting the United States. So that meant that while they hated each other, they agreed not to fight each other. But pressured by Roosevelt, for example, at the Conference of Tehran in the fall of 43, Stalin had promised that the Red Army would attack, that's Russia, the Soviet Union, I should say, would declare war in Japan and attack Japan in the Far East 3 months after the end of the war against Germany in Europe. All right, he had repeated that promise even at Potsdam Conference in late July 1945. Now, the Soviet Union finishes the war in Europe on May the 8th. Actually, I'm saying that the Soviet Union does because from the perspective of the Western allies, the Germans had surrendered on the 7th of May, but that's a different issue. So on May the 8th, in Berlin, the Germans surrender in the headquarters of Marshal Zhukov of the Red Army. And now you can count, 3 months later, that would be the 8th of August. So Stalin had repeated the promise that 3 months after the war, he would declare war. After the war with Germany, he would declare war in Japan. So in Washington, everyone knows that's going to be August the 8th. They could have been the 9th, could have been a day later. You don't know for sure. But that's why it was so important to wipe out a city somewhere in Japan, you know, with the atom bomb before that fateful day, so that it would be game over. And as I mentioned, it was believed that the impact of the dropping of the bomb would be so great that Tokyo would immediately surrender. But we know that didn't happen. But that was the idea. When it didn't happen, though, the Soviet Union did get a chance to declare war on Japan. You know, and they did, and on the 8th of August. And the following day, the Red Army attacked the Japanese army in what is now northern China, in Manchuria, which was colonized by Japan at the time. And that was a terrible blow for the Japanese, of course. And, I mean, at that stage, the entry into the war of Russia alone would probably have been enough for Japan to surrender. But then again, the entry of the war of the war of Russia meant really, or had a very negative implications as far as Burns and Truman and other leaders in Washington were concerned, because it meant that even though the Russian involvement would be very, very short, the Russians would end up sitting at the table at the end of the war to negotiate about arrangements of occupied Japan and so forth. And here you have to keep in mind that in the war in Europe, the United States had also actually entered the war rather late. In fact, the United States had not become involved until pretty well in 1942, because they declared war on Germany. Actually, Germany declared war on the United States only after Pearl Harbor in December 41. That meant, for practical purposes, the United States only became involved in the war in Europe in 1942.
And Jacques Pauwels, we're going to take a brief musical break. We're joined by Professor Jacques Pauwels, author of The Myth of the Good War. We're also joined by Minister Nobu Hanaoka. And after the musical break, we'll also welcome to the conversation Andrew Phillips, who has interviewed a few people involved, including one of the people that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. So after this brief musical break, we will continue our discussion. Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. That was the music of Preston Reed. We're now joined in our conversation by Andrew Phillips. Andrew Phillips has a long history in radio and broadcasting and journalism. And in fact, the reason we bring him on the program today is because of a couple interviews that he did, one with the Nagasaki pilot Chuck Sweeney and another with Wilfred Bercher, who was the Australian and first civilian journalist to go into Hiroshima and also expose the censorship of the New York Times. So we're not just speaking here today about Nagasaki and these untold histories, again, from this present perspective, but what went on in Japan and the dropping of the bomb, again, the propaganda was out from the beginning. The censorship was happening from the beginning to cover up what our guest Nobu Hanaoka had referred to as really not just a weapon of mass destruction, but one of mass murder. And we're joined now by Andrew Phillips to talk about his interviews with Chuck Sweeney and Wilfred Bercher. Andrew, you're with us.
Yes, I am, Mickey.
Thanks so much, Andrew, for joining us. Please tell us a little bit about your interview with both Chuck Sweeney and Wilfred Bercher for some historical perspective, and let's bring that up to the present about what this means. And also, of course, what we're doing is we're really exposing the significance and the importance of journalism and what a free press is supposed to do in our society.
Yes. Wilfred Burchett, Mickey, with B-U-R-C-H-E-T, an Australian journalist who was traveling to the battleship Missouri, where the surrender was to be signed in Tokyo Bay, heard about some great big bomb, he told me, that had gone off. We didn't know what it was, but something happened over there in Hiroshima. So as 600 journalists made their way to the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay on that fateful day of the signing of the surrender, Burchett feigned in sickness. He lay in his bunk and said, I got diarrhea, I can't go. Everyone left the building, so Wilfred got up, grabbed an umbrella, and his friend Bill Keyes, the Chicago Tribune writer, another Australian as it so happened, had given him a 45 and he put it in his pocket. And he said, I'm going to Hiroshima. He got on a train and going against the stream of people pouring out of that city. It was a few days after the bombing. I think it was actually about a week or 10 days after the bombing. John Pilger made a film about this, by the way. Wilfred traveled to Hiroshima. He arrived in Hiroshima and he was devastated. There was nothing there. He described walking around Hiroshima with his Hermes typewriter, which he sat down on a piece of rubble. He put his Hermes typewriter on a piece of rubble, and he wrote this fateful headline. I write this as a warning to the world. And he managed to get that story via Morse code back to Tokyo, where Bill Keyes had been told to wait on standby. Bill Keyes got the story, and he telexed it back to London, where it ran in the London Daily Express, I believe it was. And the story ran about the so-called atomic plague that had struck the people of Hiroshima. Because when Wilfred was walking through the rubble and went visited the hospitals, he was shocked. The people, he said, were walking around like zombies. They were in a state of kind of sleep almost. They were so shocked. The people in the hospital, laying on their hospital beds, on their pillows, he said, when they raised their heads, they left a halo of hair on the pillow. And their skin was blotched. And he said, I don't know what this is. He called it the atomic plague. He didn't know about radiation. Many years later, Mickey, Wilfred died in his early 70s, and his wife, Vessa Burchett, told me that she thought it possibly was from the cancer that he'd contracted at Hiroshima, but that's hearsay. Meanwhile, Chuck Sweeney, the bomber pilot on Boxcar, which were the aircraft that flew over Nagasaki and dropped the bomb. And in parenthesis, one should know that Nagasaki was not, repeat, not the primary target that day. The primary target was Kakura. Kakura was clouded in that day, and they just had enough fuel to go to the secondary, which was Nagasaki. So we could be, quote-unquote, talking about or commemorating Kakura Day, not Nagasaki Day. I asked Chuck Sweeney when I interviewed him in Boston in 1984 about radiation. It should be pointed out that the New York Times reported on the bomb some weeks afterwards. William Lawrence did a seven-part series. One of the first embedded journalists, he was embedded in the Manhattan Project. He did a seven-part series for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. He described in the headline, no radiation in Hiroshima. So it seemed the government was aware that there, in fact, was radiation, and they wanted to dispel fears that, in fact, there was radiation. Getting back to Chuck Sweeney, I asked him about that. Sweeney said, oh, we knew about radiation. We were told to stay away from the cloud. He said, obviously, it had no effect on me. I had eight kids.
In our studio with us is Nobu Hanaoka, and his family was at Nagasaki that day. He was just 8 months old, but many members of his family died from leukemia early in their lives. So he's been talking about how that was an unnecessary bomb, and now you're saying that it was a secondary target, and
yes.
It was just a few days after Hiroshima.
Yes.
Did Bircher ever get down to Nagasaki? Reporting coming out of there as well?
Wilfred never went to Nagasaki. But let me tell you this. I also interviewed Commander Paul Tibbets, who was in charge of the 509th Bomber Group, which actually was bombed both targets. Tibbets told me, and he said this three or four times in two interviews I conducted with him, in quotations, it was a virgin target, untouched by the war. The people, the Air Force was told, Leslie Groves had said, and LeMay said, thou shalt not bomb these targets. And amongst them was Kakura, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, I can't remember the other two. And by the way, Kyoto was put up as one of the targets. But Henry Stimson, who traveled there before the war with his wife, said, you can't bomb Kyoto. It's too important to the Japanese. We've been there. It's a beautiful city. Don't bomb it. I thought that was an interesting little aside there. But Tibbets said specifically the targets were kept as quote-unquote virgin targets so that we could test the bomb to see what kind of effect it would have on concrete, to see what kind of effect it would have on the landscape and on the buildings. It was absolutely, and this is out of his mouth, it was a virgin target, it was a test target, and as one of your other people said, your interviewee said before, it was a plutonium bomb designed by Philip Morrison, whom I also interviewed at MIT. Philip Morrison was disgusted when I did the interview. He was very saddened man. He was sitting behind his desk, I remember, sad man. He was very sad he did it. He told me that he had interviewed some of the Japanese scientists long afterwards when he himself had traveled to Nagasaki, and he's told me, in his words, it was a classroom experiment. Now, that comes from the man who designed the plutonium core, Philip Morrison.
Nobu, let's turn to you. Your family, of course, was personally impacted by this bomb, and now it's being called an experiment designed in the war, and you've called this mass murder. What's the message for today? What is our message? What would you like to say about this at this time?
Well, we still have thousands of nuclear bombs, obviously. And compared to what we had in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, what we have now is so massive. And the effect of exploding these bombs would be just unthinkable. Besides, we are spending billions and billions of dollars applying the most advanced science and technology to modernize these weapons to maximize the killing. And this is unnecessary, this is too dangerous, immoral, and we should stop it immediately. I understand that the U.S. government is planning to spend $640 billion in the next 10 years, and we should stop it immediately. I know the President Obama personally said to be committed to eliminate the nuclear bombs, but actually reality is far from it.
We're speaking with Nobu Hanaoka, minister and survivor of the Nagasaki bombing. We're also now speaking with Andrew Phillips, who's conducted a series of interviews over the decades. And also we're joined by Professor Jacques Pauwels, author of The Myth of the Good War. And Jacques Pauwels, let's bring you back in, and the same question to you. As a fellow historian, I have a bias, I suppose, but I'm interested in, from your perspective as an historian, what do you see in the present? What is the legacy of this? And you just heard what Nobu was saying. Where are we today with this? I mean, we have far more destructive, not just bombs and so forth, but just the continuous use of atomic energy. And one of the great ironies here is the Fukushima Daiichi, and we see all this radiation pouring into the Pacific Ocean. These are lessons not learned. And there's actually a chapter in the last Project Censored book by Brian Covert in Japan about, again, these ironies in the road to Fukushima and so forth. What can you offer us from an historical perspective on the present, on lessons learned and what we should be thinking about?
Well, obviously, the danger of the idea of continuing to develop weapons and make them more sophisticated and hopefully more deadly is utter madness, not only because it's going to bring us to the brink of the total destruction, essentially, but also, if you consider the real issues in the world today are unresolved, are like hunger in Africa and many other countries, you know, poverty, and if you think then about how much wealth is wasted, you know, on the development of weapons, which basically in the hope that we'll never have to use them, then that's a form of madness too, isn't it, if you think about it, that how much money goes into all this, and in the best case, we will never use any of these weapons. And the moment a weapon like this, no matter how sophisticated it is produced, it's already old-fashioned, it's already obsolete, so we start immediately by producing even more and bigger and more dangerous weapons. So it's a total race to the end, you might say. I'm pretty pessimistic about where we're heading that way. But there's many more ways in which the lessons of Hiroshima and Nagasaki can be applied to the present. And the one is that I alluded to at the beginning. There was this big dichotomy between what people were told by our dear leaders why this was done, and by the real reasons why it was done. And the reasons that people were given had really nothing to do with the real reasons, and the real reasons weren't mentioned at all. As I mentioned, the real reasons had a lot to do with the relations with the Soviet Union, and yet the reasons given were that we wanted to end the war against Japan, and they didn't want to, so there, that'll teach them a lesson, and if some of them were killed, too bad, so sad, so to speak. But today we have the same thing. We are given all kinds of wonderful excuses why we have to go to war for humanitarian reasons, you know, because we have to do this. We have to bomb countries all the time, it seems, for their own good. And yet we know, and our media should know, that the official reasons given are just basically, you know, lies or distortions. And we should really find out what the real reasons are. Only then can we prevent something like this from happening again. Unfortunately, in this respect, I think our media are very, very, you know, are leaving us, you know, leaving me personally very dissatisfied and very unhappy with the way they report all this. They seem to take for granted that whatever the government says about the next bombing is totally correct, is absolutely true. They seem to not want to look into the real reasons.
Well, let's turn to Andrew Phillips on this, on that very point, on the media. Andrew, in your interviews, part of what was going on was that the New York Times was saying there is no atomic plague. Radiation wasn't even thought about. It was just a big bomb that went boom. And let alone the idea that tens of thousands of people were just killed and then continued to die. Tens of thousands more continued to die. So how did the corporate media cover that back in during the war? And then when did they change?
Well, I can only speak for what I know about the New York Times. I've seen the headline and done some research and know of William Lawrence, the Lithuanian immigrant journalist working for the Times, who, as I said, was an embedded journalist in the Manhattan Project, who wrote that Pulitzer Prize-winning series, which I might add, I know Democracy Now! Amy Goodman's publicized that and has asked for the Pulitzer to be taken from William Lawrence, written for the New York Times, which said no radiation at Hiroshima. He was in bed with the Manhattan Project. He was to fly in to watch the bomb drop on Hiroshima, but he was late for the aircraft. It took off at about 2:15 in the morning, I think it was. But he did see the Nagasaki bomb dropped. So he was an eyewitness to history and distorted it, actually doing the government's bidding, reading from their press releases. And I suppose that's the common thread, because that goes on to today. We talk about, you know, uranium-depleted bullets and this kind of thing, which we don't hear much about in the mainstream media, but certainly Project Censored and Pacifica talk about a lot. So the more things change, the more they remain the same, I would suggest. Burchett, on the other hand, let me tell a story about Wilford. After having seen with his own eyes an eyewitness to history, he filed his story and made his way back to Tokyo. He arrived in Tokyo as the United States Army was giving a press conference to the assembled mass media about the bomb. And Wilford fortuitously walked into the back of that room. He still had the dust of Hiroshima on his clothes. He put his pack down on the floor, in which he had his notes and his camera, and listened. At some point during the press conference, he raised his hand. And Wilford was a little man. He said, in his Australian accent, he came from a little town called Poowong, a dairy town in Victoria, Australia, the same state I come from. And I met Wilford in Cuba at the Non-Aligned Nation Conference in 1979. That's when we did this interview. And Wilford, standing at the back of the room, he puts his hand up and said, "I'm Wilford Burchett. I've just come back from Hiroshima." And the world press all turn around, they whip around, and there's this little guy standing in the back, all grubby, with stubble on his face. "I just come back from Hiroshima," he said. And he told about the atomic plague, what he'd seen, unloaded his information. And at the finish of the press conference, he turned around, his bag was gone. The camera was gone, the bag was gone, it was stolen.
So that's certainly censorship writ large there, and the New York Times propaganda to try to really literally cover up this amazing atrocity that took place. And Nobu Hanoka, let's bring you back into the conversation. You no doubt know this narrative and this story well, having been there and lived there. In a minute or two, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left in this in the show today. Could you just tell us again the significance of what this means to you, and what should we be thinking about today, and what can people do? So many people hear this kind of information and they shut down. And they're bewildered by some of this information because it has been covered up.
Right.
And it's not that it isn't there, but it's very difficult and painful for people. And you first and foremost have witnessed and experienced a lot of pain because of this. What can you do to help people understand why we might need to act against this now? This is not just 1945. It's 2013. And these dangers are with us.
Well, you know, because of the repeated nuclear disarmament talks, I think the general public is under the impression that we don't have the nuclear threat anymore. But it's not true. The reality is far from it. I think it's very important that we all know that we still have the nuclear arms. And the danger of nuclear power plants, the leakage and accidents and so forth are still there. Besides, we don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. We have to stop it. We have to make sure that everyone hears these stories. I think the media is very, very important.
Chuck Powell's 1 minute concluding remarks from you about, you know, what can we do, what can we and what should we be doing, do you think, as an historian in the present? What should we be doing about these very real issues? These aren't just past issues.
Well, we should certainly all speak out again, any way we possibly can, and that's different ways for different people, against this threat. I mean, we can, here in Canada, talk to our members of parliament. You have your representatives in Congress and so on. I think we should also write to our media. I occasionally write a nasty letter to the papers here, but pointing out things which don't agree with and which the kind of distortions that we have been talking about. We try to contribute, to online magazines that are alternatives to the media, which I tend to disagree with Andrew, that saying it's more of the same thing with respect to the media now. I think it's much worse than it used to be. For many countries now, there's really no more unorthodox voices to be heard at all, where there used to be some, at least in the 60s, so I think it's gone worse. So I think we can all make contributions, mostly small, but sometimes bigger, do our very best. So that's the only remark I can make at this point.
Well, Jacques, The Myth of the Good War, the book that you've written, came out about 10 years ago.
Yeah,
I've been using it consistently in my political sociology classes, and it is every semester ranked by my students as the most important book they read that semester.
It's never been reviewed by any newspaper.
It certainly has been ignored in terms of, yeah, I mean, because It tells the truth about the horrors of war, and not just the bombings, but the entire episode from Dresden on, and the mass murder. And there's no other way to explain war that in any other context today, as Reverend Nobu has talked about, other than mass murder, and that's even drones, striking wherever they are. So, Andrew, are you still with us there?
Yes, I am, and I just want to make sure that people know Wilfred's small book, but an important book, on his experience in Hiroshima. It's called Shadows of Hiroshima by Wilfred Burchett. Shadows of Hiroshima. You can find it on Google, and it's an amazing little book.
The virgin target issue. Hiroshima was a virgin target, and I imagine Nagasaki was too. And one of the reasons for that was that to make even a bigger impression, as I mentioned earlier, the impression had to be big, and the action to be that needed to be followed, that Washington wanted to be followed, had to be speedy. They wanted Tokyo to surrender immediately. And if to bomb a city that was already half destroyed, would not have had the same impact as wiping out a city that was still intact, a virgin target. And this was the same with the bombing of Dresden in February 1945, when we still didn't have nuclear bombs, atomic bombs, but we had a massive air fleet, and we could bomb the hell out of any city, and we did. And we did that under the noses of the Soviets, and we wiped out also a virgin target. So Dresden, as well as Hiroshima, as well as Nagasaki, were virgin targets deliberately chosen.
And that's the voice of Professor Jacques Powles. Thanks so much for joining us, author of The Myth of the Good War. Also, special thanks to Nobuaki Hanaoka for joining us today. And also thanks from New York to Andrew Phillips. Thanks so much for joining us today for the 68th anniversary program on Nagasaki.
You're welcome.
Special thanks today also go to Anthony Fest and Rod Akeel. And we will see you next week. Thanks for joining us.